Ok, donc on va entamer cette quatrième et dernière conférence de Gabriel Kotlian. Comme il a beaucoup de matériel à couvrir, probablement ce cours va durer 1 heure et demie. Plus discussion. Donc, it's all yours.
Temperature superconducting materials. And the reason, sort of my motivation for doing that, is that we really don't understand exactly what's going on here. I mean, we have a large space, and we don't understand what are the coordinate axes that we need to look at in order to parameterize it. And when you're sort of in something which is unknown, I mean, like in science, the way you proceed is you just sort of go around, look at the various things and try to make sense of the various species in the hope that eventually one will make sense of the whole thing. And we started with the elements, and here we really know what are the coordinates that we need to take in terms of understanding the superconductivity of the materials of the elements, and it's basically lambda, which is the strength of the phonon coupling, which is more generally the Eliashberg function that we define, and the phonon and the characteristic phonon frequency. And basically, the thing that does not allow us to really design things here very well is that these two parameters are linked. So you just take a material, you think you increase one, and then you decrease the other. But at least we know what we're doing. We have a clear set of axes here. Then we moved to something like MgV2, and there we understood that life is a little bit more complicated, that really there's this phenomena of orbital differentiation, of momentum space differentiation, and nature likes to use that. At least in there, the nature exploited that to keep the structure intact and give us a surprisingly high temperature for phonons, something like 40 degrees. And then we moved to the high temperature superconductors, and there I proposed that I think we might know what is the axis that controls high TC, in the sense that an important axis here is the charge transfer energy of the material, and as we reduce the charge transfer energy, the TC goes up. So we looked a little bit at the Coupe rates, and we tried to find somehow some guidance in here, and that's where we left the last lecture. So in this lecture, what I would like to do is I would like to sort of complete this this tour, this overview of the field, and I'll start with a really important classic example, which is the heavy fermion systems, and then we'll look at a few more things, trying to ask some questions about the whole.
It's okay? All right. Okay, so let's start then with the heavy fermion systems. And like in all these superconductors that we looked at, the history is always interesting. I mean, it's a field which is tangled in confusion and accidental discoveries, and the heavy fermion superconductivity is also not an exception. And that was discovered in 1979 in cerium copper 2 silicon 2, which is what's called a heavy fermion material. It's a material which at low temperatures give birth to a Fermi liquid of very, very heavy quasiparticles. And as a result, when the superconductivity occurs, the specific heat of the objects which are condensing is very, very large. And the reason why this discovery is sort of tangled in surprises is that Frank reported his discovery in 1979, but it took a very long time for people to believe that this was a real effect. In fact, the effect that the superconductivity in serum copper 2 silicon 2 had been detected before in a paper by Dieter Wohlleben, but it's only mentioned in a footnote, and because the authors believe it was an artifact, but it's reported in a year before that serum copper 2 silicon 2 was in fact had a superconducting transition. It was also seen 5 years earlier in uranium beryllium 13, and it is reported again in a paper, but it's also dismissed in the paper as a filamentary effect. So all the credit goes to Steglitz that he really recognized that for what it is, a genuine effect, and he went and discovered all the properties of this, and showing that it's a genuine effect, this became a huge field. Of course, the heavy fermion superconductors have a very low TC. As we noticed, it was really at the bottom of our map. And as a result, it was really regarded as a curiosity, something for people in academia to study, but nobody took this very, very seriously until superconductivity was discovered in the 115 system, because then, again, the trend up began, and it started with the serum cobalt indium 5, what's called the 115 serum. And that was the result of studying quantum criticality in a three-dimensional system by Lonsdale in Lonsdale's group. And then when cerium is substituted by plutonium, the TC now goes to 20 degree Kelvin, and then it becomes to in the range that it's considered to be a high temperature superconductor. And people now are accustomed to 20 Kelvin superconductivity as a norm. But as I said in the historical overview, before the organics, before the heavy fermions, people were stuck at 20 Kelvin and thought that that was the limit. And every time that one would get even close to that was a real surprise. So this is sort of an event to be taken very seriously. So here we have some overview of the resistivities of these heavy fermion materials. For me, the heavy fermion systems are extremely important because they raise all sorts of fundamental questions. If you look at the resistivity of the heavy fermion systems on a very, very broad scale, you see that the resistivity rises, so it's more or less flat until you reach some maximum, and then all of a sudden drops, and this drop of the resistivity is interpreted as the formation of some heavy Fermi liquid, which is coherent and therefore can move through the lattice, which is why the resistivity drops, and then eventually this ultimately becomes superconducting. But if you look at this curve a little bit more closely, then you see that there is some difference between these compounds. For example, the uranium-beryllium-13 really continues to rise the resistivity until eventually drops. So uranium-beryllium-13 never really undergoes this conversion to a heavy Fermi liquid. And, yes?
It raises up to TC.
Yes, here you have it. Never goes down. So there's no room for argument. It's completely clear that this guy did not undergo that conversion that the other materials were supposed to have. I mean, the canonical picture is that here, the local moments, the Fs, are scattering the conduction electrons, and you can think in terms of two subsystems. Here, when you reach this maximum, they begin to bind, they form a heavy system of quasiparticles, and it drops. And it's possible that the superconductivity emerges from that Fermi liquid, but sometimes it still emerges without having the Fermi liquid form. And a canonical system where one can actually really verify that the heavy Fermi liquid forms is UPT3. To my knowledge, this is really the only system of these guys where one has enough range of a T square to convince ourselves that the resistivity in the low temperature regime is Fermi liquid-like, and therefore this drop is really understood in terms of condensation of heavy quasi-particles. Here we have the 115s, and the reason why I brought the resistivity of the 115s is because this is a system which we understand very well. I think this is a very good laboratory for theorists because this is a case that the methods we have work beautifully. Those materials really behave quite locally, and the local approximation to the level that we've been able to test it is really almost exact in the sense that we've gone down to very, very low temperatures with single site and two site DMFT, and it's difficult to see at finite temperatures much difference. But notice that this cerium 115 is not the, so here I did the comparison of theory and experiment, a paper that I wrote some time ago with Ji-Hoon Shim and Christian Haule. But notice that down to 5 Kelvin, this material has not yet reached a Fermi liquid region. So this perhaps is safer to say that many of these high temperature superconductors like to be in a crossover region where they become superconductors either while they are undergoing the conversion to Fermi liquid or close to that conversion. Now, in the old days, people would say, well, the reason why we're interested in the heavy fermions is because it's only the ratio of TC over TF which is important. And they would say, well, TF is very low. It's like 10 degree Kelvin. The superconductivity is 1 degree Kelvin. So this ratio is like 1/10, which is roughly what where the maximum of the cold atom people seem to be. The maximum of TC seems to be when this ratio is 0.1. But notice that this really makes sense, provided that the TF is the TF of a Fermi liquid. So namely, we can imagine that we manufacture ourselves a system of quasi-particles. It has a nice TF, and then we can study that as our starting point. That's our artificial system that we want to study. Once we get in this crossover region, this may have absolutely no meaning. OK. Now, there are many questions. For example, I mean, in the Migdal-Eliasberg theory, we said that the coupling, whatever coupling we have, is multiplied by Z. So it's not completely clear how these guys, which have a very small Z, Z here being the quasi-particle residue, how these guys actually become superconducting. So it was a field of great interest and continues to be. And an important aspect of this is the process of condensation. And I will return to this process of condensation a little bit later in the talk. But yes. No, that's the quasi-particle Z.
No, but yes, but that was in the electron form, due to electron form.
Yes, sure.
It matters.
Yes, and ideally we would like to have mechanisms where we don't care how small Z is, or that work even when Z is zero, or makes no sense, right? But people think in this field, still 90% of the workers, or perhaps even 95% of the workers in this field, think by analogy to the electron-phonon coupling, which is why I described at the beginning what we really know about the electron-phonon coupling. So here we have UPT3. And another thing I would like to remark is that even in UPT3, which is the canonical Fermi liquid, okay, this is the only guy where we can really document a T-square law. These susceptibilities are not exactly Fermi liquid-like, in the sense that it's not a clear region where here we have constant plus T-square. So it's possible that the spin degrees of freedom and the charge degrees of freedom really reach the asymptotic limit at different scales. But here, that if we take this as the prototype or the textbook Fermi liquid that undergoes condensation, we can try to estimate what is the condensation, how much entropy goes, by simply noticing that the entropy is just the integral of the specific heat. And here we have the divided by temperature. So if here we plot specific heat divided by temperature, we can estimate this area. We can see how much there is in here. Okay? So this is easy to do. And if we do this integral, here we get 0.05. Yes?
Now, you pointed out that some material, assuming medium 3, reach Fermi liquid, and then
Much below, I don't know, but below.
Okay. So, in those materials, I also imagine, I know that the gamma has reached the plateau. Right?
Yeah.
But in other materials, which is those which do not reach the Fermi.
Right.
Presumably, well, this I don't know, but presumably the gamma.
Right.
Does not really. Reach
okay, so this is this is the.
Really compute SN?
Well, the okay, so this is what this transparency is supposed to walk you through. So I just took one, like UPT3, where gamma has more or less asymptote. So gamma here is flat. Okay? So here I have the jump, and then I can do the integral. This is some impurity which is there. So here I can really do the computation. Here I took the cerium 115, where, as you said, I've been hinting, the Fermi liquid does not form. So you see, the gammas keep rising, if you want to extrapolate that. And we know that because we apply a magnetic field to remove the superconductivity. And we can see that the specific heat, the gamma, keeps going up. So this is the curve in the field. And this is the curve without the field. But still, we have the specific heat. We can do the integral. This gives us the entropy of the superconductor. Ideally, what we would like to do is we would like to do a subtraction and see what is the entropy of the superconductor relative to the entropy of the would have been normal state. And this can be done two ways, either by applying a field when the field is low enough. This we can do in heavy fermions, and that's why people like the heavy fermions. In the cuprates, you need to apply fields which are so large that you completely alter the character of the system. But here the fields are small. With 50 kilohertz that you kill the superconductivity, and then you can do this calculation and see what the normal state would do. So that's why people like this laboratory of heavy fermion materials. It allows you to do some things and ask certain questions that are not so easy to formulate in cuprates. But still, I mean, it's sort of interesting that the superconducting state here absorbs 1/3 of log 2. That's a big chunk of entropy. And it's very, very remarkable that there is a material which actually does that. That's a reason why, basically, these heavy fermion systems have been a subject of a lot of attention. So here we have superconductivity from a Fermi liquid to a superconductor. And I just put still in question marks because what we learned in the studies of the 115s is that the process of crossover from the high temperature local moment regime to the formation of the heavy fermion, it's actually quite long, and there's a lot of things happening there. And different parts of the Fermi surface are doing different things. And as I said, the coherence scale for the spin might be slightly different than for the conduction electrons. OK. So this is sort of completes the introduction to the heavy fermions. But I cannot leave this field without saying a little bit more about the order parameter and the symmetry of the order parameter, because at the beginning of the lectures and throughout the lectures, I really concentrated on singlet superconductivity. And it turns out that this is too restrictive in order to understand these materials. And if you remember, I started by looking at the wave function of the pairs. And the wave functions of the pairs is something like C dagger K. And here I will put an index sigma, which I explain what it is. And this naturally has two indices, sigma and sigma prime. And the reason why I also want to go over this is because this is something which is not completely understood. So we take a material like a heavy fermions, and let's focus on one specific band. We know that parity is a good quantum number. And we know, at least in the normal state, that time reversal symmetry is a good symmetry. So I can imagine that I have at least two bands on the Fermi level, and I can imagine that sigma is a label for the two degenerate bands. In systems without spin orbit coupling, then sigma would be just be the spin. Here we can think of it as J, if you want, at the gamma point. But of course, in a generic point in the Brillouin zone, JZ does not make sense as a label. But there is some label that I can use so that sigma and sigma bar are sort of time reversed of each other. Okay, so I have these two bands. So formally, then we can think of this as a pseudo spin. And then basically, as I said, there are two possibilities. One possibility is that it's a singlet, which means that phi of k, in this case, is proportional to just sigma y, in which case, then phi of k is an even function of k. But there's also the other possibility. The other possibility is that phi of k is actually proportional to a symmetric matrix. So the most general symmetric matrix is I sigma y times the Pauli matrix. And then this can be multiplied by an arbitrary vector of k. And this d now has to be an odd function of k. So d of minus k has to be equal to minus d of k. And then I have what's called a superconducting state, which has odd parity. Unfortunately, in the literature, this is also called triplet. But I should stress, in the heavy fermion systems, the idea of triplet makes absolutely no sense because the spin orbit coupling is huge, is one of the largest scales in the problem. And therefore, what we're sort of orienting in a spin is not really the spin of the particle. But this is, again, like everything I said at the beginning, it's completely rigorous. We have, nature gives us these two possibilities. K is a good quantum number, parity is a good quantum number, so either my wave function is even in K or it's odd in K. If it's odd in K, I just call it triplet. And in that case, it must have this form. Okay? And then the challenge for the theorist and for the experimentalist is to figure out what this function looks like. And having these possibilities give rise to a few sort of counterintuitive things and that, to my knowledge, are not fully understood, which I'll describe in a moment. So let's take, for example, d of k now, pointing along the z-axis, so z, 0, 0, dz of k. Okay, so that means if we do the multiplication of the Pauli matrices, then what we have in here is the three matrices which are involved in here are just minus 1, 1, 1, 1, and 0, 1, 1, 0. So if the d vector is pointing along the z direction, what this means is that we've chosen the simplest matrix, which is 0, 1, 1, 0. And what does that mean for my state? Well, my state is in principle psi sigma sigma prime, sigma sigma prime. That's how I connect sort of the d vector to the actual state of the two particles that make the Cooper pairs. And then since here I have one and one, this is just up, down, plus down, up. Okay? So we have sort of where we're up and down, as I said, refers to this quasi-spin index. So that, in some sense, says that we really paired Jz of k with minus Jz of minus k. So we expect that in this case, if we apply a magnetic field parallel to D, so if I apply H along the z-axis, then we're going to shift the energy of this relative to that, right? And we expect that that will have some cost, so we expect the susceptibility to drop. On the other hand, if we do the exercise of applying now the field parallel to D, perpendicular to the D vector, then what we use is we have a D vector now that will look like 0 dy 0. That means that the wave functions of the pairs, now I have to put in here the corresponding matrix. So for dy, I have to put this matrix here, 1, 1, which is the simplest one. So now the state that I have involves up, up, plus down, down. So that means that in this state, what's paired is Jz of k and Jz of minus k. So it's the same Jz. So now if I apply a field perpendicular to D, nothing happens. I mean, I'm moving the two guys which are paired by the same amount. So the nice shift in this case should stay constant. So when I apply H perpendicular to D, a nice shift does not change. And that's the thing that makes the triplet superconductors possible to identify relatively easily, in the sense that if you have a singlet, then the nice shift always drops. And you see that in many, many materials, the nice shift drops. For example, in cuprates, in all the standardized wave superconductors, if you see a nice shift that doesn't drop, then you suspect that you have triplet superconductivity. And in fact, in helium, where all these things were developed, this sort of worked quite nicely, in the sense that there's one phase, which is called the A phase, where the order parameter, the D vector of the A phase was something like Z kx plus iky. And then, indeed, one could really see all these predictions at work. Okay, so that's one thing that we can say basically on the basis of symmetry without knowing very much. The other thing that we can say on the basis of symmetry, and again, unfortunately, there is a little bit of confusion in the literature, but is that this, whether singlet or triplet, the order parameter has to transform according to the symmetry of the group. And therefore, this function, phi of k, in principle, should be expandable in terms of the basis functions of the reducible representations. So we have to pick a basis. And this can be a vector if this is a triplet, or a scalar if this is a singlet. But it has to be expressible this way. And the thing which makes this problem relatively simple is that our materials are either hexagonal or tetragonal, and as a result, we have either one or two-dimensional representations. So there are not too many choices. So either we have one eta, or we have two etas. Okay? So nothing else is possible. Now, these basis functions are listed in tables, and there's a nice review by Louis Taillefer and Bob Joint that lists them. And the other thing which is sort of worthwhile to know, because it's sort of confusing, is that there is actually finite number. Each one of those basis functions can be written as some function which has all the symmetries of the lattice plus some finite number of functions which transform according to the irreducible representation. So this number is finite, and you can also find it in tables. Of course, the number of invariant functions is infinite, so you cannot list all of them, but you can list all of them modulo a fully rotational, a fully invariant function. So that's what you need to know about the representations. And then you are left with very, very few possibilities because for your free energy. Because if it's one-dimensional, we already know the lambda Ginzburg. It has a quadratic and a quartic term, and that's all there is. And if it's two-dimensional, it's slightly more complicated, but it's the quadratic term cannot distinguish, so we're going to take eta equals to eta x and eta y, because as I said, there are only two-dimensional representations and one-dimensional ones. Then we can write some term that will go like eta to the fourth. Then we can put the other quadratic terms that are allowed. It has to be invariant under gauge transformations. And then we have eta x squared plus times eta y squared. So we have three coefficients, b1 and b2. And then we have very, very few states that can come out of minimizing this. And they all have physical consequences. So if you want to minimize, you have a vector. You have a vector, eta x, eta y. The minimum can be at either 1, 0, or 0, 1. Or the minimum can be at 1, 1, or 1, minus 1. Or the minimum can be at 1, I, or 1, minus I. So those are all the possible triplet superconductors. You can describe all of them just on the basis of symmetry. And in principle, experimentalists should be able to tell us which one it is, because if your minimum is either along 1, 0, 0, 1, that breaks the fourfold symmetry to a twofold symmetry. So there should be a lattice distortion. And if the system decides to go to 1i or 1 minus i, you put an I in there. So you break time reversal symmetry. So the time reversal symmetry gets broken. We should be able to detect it. So that's basically a very, very quick overview of what's possible. And a nice example of this was provided by Helium and then by the Ruthenates, where people sort of tried to apply the ideas from helium 3 to the strontium ruthenium 2, and then there what was proposed is that the d of k is aligned along the z axis and is of the form kx plus minus IKY. And this is something very popular these days. It's called the P plus IP state. And that was proposed by Maurice Rice and Manfred Sigrist on the basis of analogies with helium-3. Okay, so now we know what we need to know about triplet superconductors. We can take a quick look at what the ruthenates actually did. And I think that I bring this example because I think it's sort of quite generic of things which we still don't understand. So the ruthenates are drawn here. It's a very nice system for many reasons. It's extremely clean, has a perovskite structure, has a clean phase transition around 1.5 Kelvin in pure samples that was discovered by Maeno. And if one looks at the night shift, the first thing that was measured is the night shift with the field applied in the plane, so perpendicular to the d-axis where Sigrist has suggested the d-vector is. And what they've shown is that the night shift essentially doesn't change, as opposed to a singlet superconductor where the night shift actually drops. And that was reported by the group of Ishida in Japan. So this seems to be a triplet superconductor. Now, the other reason why I like this is because this is another system where now, thanks to the MFT methods and thanks to Yerney Marvle, we have some understanding. We feel that we know what the quasiparticles are doing. We know what the different Fermi surfaces are doing. So we have some microscopic understanding of what's happening, at least in the normal phase. And as I said, once you decided that you have a triplet, then if you have a degenerate representation, there are not that many options. You either break lattice symmetry or you break time reversal symmetry. So here, mu SR was done. And when you reach TC, the relaxation rate increases because you're breaking time reversal symmetry. You have more fields which can dephase the muon. So up to this point, it seemed that the proposal that was made theoretically was in complete agreement with all the experimental data. Unfortunately, this is not completely the case, in the sense that experimentalists have the bad habit of not stopping at when things agree perfectly with the theory, but they sort of like to dig more and check all the aspects of the theory. That's a very bad habit that experimentalists tend to have. And they decided that they also wanted to check what happens when you measure the night shift and now putting the field perpendicular to the AB plane. And this is a very, very difficult experiment because this is a very low temperature superconductor, so you have to use a very, very small field. The easy experiment was done first when the field was in the plane and therefore didn't affect the TC. But they did the experiment with the field perpendicular to the plane, and the night shift, which according to the theory should have now gone down because there is some de-pairing, didn't do anything. It's as flat as the one in along the z-axis. So this part is not understood. And my feeling looking at the literature is that we don't completely understand this pseudo-spin index. We really need to do a better theory to try to map the spin into the pseudo-spin if we want to account for all the effects that are being seen. I mean, this just taking the analogy that this is like Jay-Z and that seems to be at least too naive, or this proposal is actually not right. Another possibility that has been suggested is that actually this D vector can perhaps rotate as you apply the field, but it's also hard, given the test that they've done in magnetic fields, is not so easy to believe that. The other thing that has not been detected, there should be edge currents. If you have a complex order parameter like this, the currents should be moving around, and people have not been able to see that. So this problem is not completely solved, but at least I think that we can get a big cut at the problem and understand it on a fairly general basis. And to wrap up the field of sort of heavy fermion superconductivity, and to illustrate again the power of the methods we have, this is the famous UPT3 phase diagram. When we look at the phase diagram, we see that there are several superconducting phases, even without magnetic field. So already that tells you that this must be using a degenerate representation, because you must be able to switch between different phases by applying very, very small perturbations. So you need to start from a degenerate situation. So this tells you that we have here somehow like a twofold degenerate representation. So just from the phase diagram alone, you can say something. Then you do the night shift, and then here the night shift behaves just like in the ruthenates. It doesn't change much in any direction. So it's definitely not a singlet. So now you go to your list, and there are very, very few candidates for what this order parameter can be. So again, just on the basis of general considerations, one can restrict that quite a lot. And this is sort of another example which is that I bring up, which is the uranium ruthenium 2 silicon 2, which is a system which I like a lot. And again, at very low temperatures, this becomes also a superconductor. And in this case, from the night shift measurements and other considerations, it seems that is a singlet, is something which has even parity, but still breaks time reversal symmetry. So there are many many examples. It's a very, very rich field, and it's not completely settled by any means. And it has also experimental complications that somehow there seems to be always some magnetism, which I believe is parasitic in this material, which is sort of lurking around. In UPT3, people detected fluctuating moments down to very, very low temperatures. Then at extremely low temperatures, they managed to detect the ordering of those moments. So there's always this issue of magnetism floating around. But still, I think that we have fairly clear clues as to what we need to look at. And I believe that in the next few years, this problem, using modern theoretical and experimental techniques, will get more or less sorted out. Uranium ruthenium 2 silicon 2 is very special in the sense that there people manage to prepare samples almost rid of the parasitic magnetism, something that they have not been able to do in the UPT3 system. Okay, so that's probably where I would like to leave. Yes? Yes. Yes.
The difficulty which arises is what is the hyperfine coupling?
Yes.
And this can be an important problem. If you look at IPCO, and if you look at in the C direction, you find the night shift doesn't move. But the reason is very simple. The hyperfine coupling is vanishing there. It's a compensation.
Yeah, but you first measure in a normal state, and you see that a normal state is changing a lot.
Yeah.
And in heavy, so.
What you need is to know perfectly the
You need to know it's non-zero. For making the qualitative considerations, you need to know it's non-zero. And in these heavy fermion systems, the susceptibility is changing a lot in the normal state. So you can see that you always do first the plot of night shift versus susceptibility.
I don't think this is the case in the ruthenate.
In the ruthenates, there is a not exactly Curie law, but there is some temperature dependence in the susceptibility. So again, one can actually check. So this is a serious problem. I mean, people are trying to work out theoretically some way out of this apparent paradox.
In the ruthenates, you have oxygen and ruthenium NMI, and it has different hyperfine couplings, and it's reasonably well understood there.
Also, I think in the next few years, we'll be able to even compute theoretically these things and just get those matrix elements out of the way and be able to focus on the physics. OK, so let me sort of now skip ahead. And I would like to sort of to move, now that we more or less encounter the first family, I will skip ahead some details on heavy fermion systems. And I would like to go and discuss now a little bit more other materials and mechanisms. And this is sort of like an overview, in the sense that this is a transparency that many people use to argue various points. But it shows that cuprates, Bethshcar salts, heavy fermion materials, this is the cerium copper 2 silicon 2, this is the cerium 115s, all these materials are somehow close to some other phase which has magnetic character. And there are different ways of thinking about this. And one way is in terms of being close to a quantum critical point where the magnetism would go away. And the thought goes that, OK, as the magnetism goes away, you still have some spin fluctuations left over. And this can be responsible for the pairing. And that can basically be the mechanism which underlies all this. So this is what I call the spin fluctuation point of view. And people ask me about the history. I traced it the best I could. It starts really with this in the 60s, where people were trying to understand things like palladium and realized that palladium should have been a superconductor because it has strong electron-phonon coupling, but in reality, it's not. And then Engelsberg and Doniak and Burke and Schrieffer, in very, very close by papers, suggested that the reason why they don't superconduct is because these materials are nearly ferromagnetic. So that's the first appearance of spin fluctuations. And they appear in order to explain why superconductivity is not seen. Because ferromagnetic spin fluctuations, if they're very slow, they're like magnetic impurities. And magnetic impurities are known to destroy superconductivity. Now, then comes helium. And in helium, instead of playing a destructive role, they play a constructive role. So instead of killing superconductivity in helium, and that's basically work of Anderson and Brickman and Leggett and others, they figure out that in helium-3, which is a system which is not very far from having magnetism and where there are spin fluctuations, those spin fluctuations could be actually the glue which are mediating the P-wave superconductivity which is seen in those systems. Notice that helium-3 is a canonical Fermi liquid system in the sense that their quasi-particles more or less do form, and then at much lower temperatures, they pair. So that concept of glue definitely makes sense in there. So around the same time, people were also interested in itinerant magnetism. And in the 70s, people were trying to understand how can it be that you take a material which is an itinerant magnet, and at high temperatures, it has a Curie-Weiss law? So the simplest explanation, of course, is that you form local moments. But the numbers didn't work out in the sense that the coefficient of the Curie term was not this, it was not in any way related to the size of the moment, which ordered, which was extremely small. And that really forced people to perfect the development of these itinerant theories of magnetism in the sense that just instead of just doing plain RPA, which is what was done in the first couple of papers on these two subjects, here people had to take into account more nonlinear effects, mode-mode coupling effects in the magnetism. And that's something that was done by Moria and Murat and Doniak, and that's what's called the itinerant theory of magnetism. In the language of today, what they were trying to understand is what happens when you have a quantum critical point of an itinerant system. That's the problem that Moria essentially solved in three dimensions. And the theories that we have is essentially quasi-particles which interact with the boson. If you want to be sort of phenomenological, the boson is the spin fluctuation, and the fermions are the itinerant fermions. And the microscopic theories are the Haber model, for example. So that was sort of in the 70s. Then heavy fermion superconductivity came. And then we could use all that stuff to understand what's happening in the heavy fermions, because the heavy fermions are not far from magnetic states. And then several people, Emery, Belmonod, Bourbonnais, Miyake, Schmidt-Rink, Varma, Scalapino, Hirsch, Lowe, they proposed essentially the paramagnon mechanism, but now in the D-wave channel rather than in the P-wave channel like in helium, because they knew that the heavy fermions in its large variety were D-wave superconductors, or at least they were singlet superconductors. Even though, as I showed, I mean, this is not completely clear. Some of them are clearly triplets. So that's basically triggered, that's sort of like the genesis, if you want, of the modern theories of high TC. This was done in 1986, and they started to develop these methods of calculation, which is RPA, or a little bit more than RPA, to try to understand heavy fermion superconductivity. And then basically come the cuprates. All this is taken over to explain the cuprates. And it's now one of the and there's really now a lot of work in that area. So that's basically how we got to this. Now, there's an alternative point of view which can be called correlated superconductivity for the cuprates that comes to the cuprates, but can also be used to analyze all these materials that I showed in this phase diagram. And that point of view basically originates in the work of Phil Anderson in his Science article in 1987, where he somehow traces the superconductivity of the cuprates to the proximity of a Mott insulating phase. So it's different than the previous point of view, because in the previous point of view, what you need to find is you need to find a critical point of an itinerant system where the spin fluctuation softens and you form an itinerant magnet. Here, what you need to find is you need to find a transition between a metallic state and a Mott insulating state. So those are different points. Those are different references. And it's not clear, basically, what is better or what should be used to make sense of nature. So this was also developed fairly quickly. But as you see, this is much newer than the spin fluctuation theory. This only had 25 years or so, 30 years to develop. More like 20 years to develop. And immediately following Anderson's suggestions, people tried to work out these ideas. And Antoine has covered in his course these things, so I will not cover this in any detail. But basically, the ideas are that one tries to sort of separate the pairing and the onset of coherence, which would go together in the spin fluctuation model with using essentially two separate order parameters. And the early calculations using Slade bosons were extremely successful in the sense that already in 1987 and 1988 predicted a lot of what was discovered later in the cuprates. Predicted D-wave superconductivity. It predicted the existence of the pseudo-gap with the same symmetry as the superconducting state. So it was sort of quite surprising how much predictive power this thing had. And it contains some interesting ideas. I mean, some were sort of known before, in the sense that if one renormalizes the kinetic energy, one can actually give rise to the possibility of superconductivity to emerge, but that really requires that the pairing strength is not strongly renormalized. And I think that's one of the key insights of the RVB approach, that if we can actually have, if we can sort of renormalize the kinetic energy a little bit, but then retain the pairing strength among the quasiparticles, not multiply that pairing strength by Z, like in the conventional Migdal-Eliashvili theory, then some high-temperature superconductivity can emerge. The other point is what gets paired here are the spins, not the charge. We're trying to really form singlets as we approach a MOT insulating state, which is called an RVB state without long-range order. And pairing spins is not hindered by the long-range Coulomb interactions. So there's no pseudo-potential that we need to fight. There's no need to have retardation. And then what happens, though, is that when you approach the MOT insulator, the local charge stiffness, and I stress local because this is really a local effect, gets renormalized to zero, and that's how the superconductivity disappears. Or in other words, superconductivity requires the formation of quasiparticles. We start with a high temperature state where we don't have quasiparticles, and then at low temperatures, as you become superconducting, the quasiparticles form. And that's basically what's called the Bose-Einstein condensation temperature of the Slay bosons. That's what controls the local charge stiffness. And that's why, as you approach the MOT insulator, the superconductivity gets reduced to zero.
Gavin,
yes?
What you mean by that is that the quasiparticles form at the same time the system becomes
superconducting. Right. So we introduce two order parameters, one for singlet pairing, and one for formation of quasiparticles. And to have superconductivity, you need both quasiparticles and spin pairing. And as I said, this was sort of interesting ideas and predicted quite a few things. So I believe there's also some truth in there. And the rest of the history is now being written with cluster DMFT methods over the past decade and continues today. Various groups are actually advancing the formulation of superconductivity near a MOT insulating state, as opposed to superconductivity near a quantum critical point of itinerant fermions. Both situations are realized in nature. There's no doubt that the things that Moria and Doniak studied in the 70s are certainly exist in many, many transition metals. And the cerium indium 3 is a classic example of that paradigm. The thing which is at stake in the community is whether this is closer or that other paradigm is closer to the actual materials. And for that, we need to look at the phase diagrams and what the materials are doing in more and the examples in more detail. So I said that I would say nothing about the techniques, but something about the spin fluctuation theory, because that's sort of the main axis that I took in preparing this talk. So this action I took from a paper of Gil Lonsarich and Montu, which is very readable, and allows me to sort of make the comparisons of the spin fluctuation theory and what you already know from my second lecture on Migdal-Eliashvili theory. So what we have here is a bunch of fermions, and they interact with a retarded interaction, which is, this is the spin of the electrons, of the itinerant electrons. And here, instead of having a phonon, you have the susceptibility. But from the formal point of view, this is completely identical. So basically, if you call that phonon, there's no way of distinguishing the spin fluctuation except that this is acting on the spins rather than on the charge. But that's sort of a very, very minor difference. So formally, the theories are very similar, but there are differences. So what are the differences? Well, first, the phonons are really fundamental degrees of freedom, and therefore we know exactly what they are, and we can really calculate their parameters. This spin fluctuation here, this chi, are really emergent degrees of freedom. So we have no simple recipe, say from a density functional theory calculation, to extract what is the coupling to these quasi-particles. Okay, so in that sense, this is not in as good of a footing as the Migdal-Eliasberg theory of superconductivity. The second very important difference is that phonons propagate. Okay, we measure them in neutron scattering. They're propagating entities. They're weakly damped. I mean, in fact, it's the small width of the phonons which allows us to recognize what lambda is in a neutron scattering experiment. On the other hand, the spin fluctuations are totally damped. So if you look at the propagator of the spin fluctuations, the phonon, if you remember, was omega zero, omega square minus omega zero square. So the spin fluctuation is completely different, is omega square, but then we have some q square, and then we have some I gamma, where gamma is the and here we can put a mass. So the damping is very, very large, and it's really the damping that provides the characteristic scale of the spin fluctuation. So it's the damping which is what's called in this theory the spin fluctuation characteristic energy. Okay, so if you have a propagator like that, so let me just write the propagator and then you can take the imaginary part if you want. This gamma can depend on Q and omega, and how it depends on Q and omega depends if the material is ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic or conservation laws. But the important point is that this is the thing that gives rise to the low energy excitations. Okay, so there's really no precise analogy between the Debye energy and the spin fluctuation energy, even though, as you'll see, it is this spin fluctuation energy what controls the TC, just like the Debye energy controls the TC of the electron phonon problem. The most important difference, however, is that these spin fluctuations are important only when they're close to an instability. If you just take an ordinary metal, such as aluminum, nobody cares about the spin fluctuations. Why? Because the system is not anywhere close to an antiferromagnetic instability. So yes, there is some collective mode, but you don't see it. The only time that this thing is important is when you're close to that magnetic instability. And therefore, the analogy is with phonons whose Debye frequency is actually going to zero. Those are what we call anharmonic phonons. Those are precisely the ones we don't know how to treat. In fact, in Migdal-Eliasberg theory, to make the whole thing fly, what I did is I said, OK, I know the phonon propagator from experiment, and I put it there, and that was my alpha square F. Of course, if I'm just add the instability, at the structural instability, we don't know what is the phonon propagator. It's clear that it's going to be a very strong feedback of the electrons on the phonons, and that's precisely where I don't know how to do Migdal-Eliasberg theory. So this is really outside the scope, even though it looks very similar.
So
yes?
You cannot define an alpha square F, right?
No, we can define everything. Once you have this, I can define alpha square F.
Formally,
I can define, just like I did. Well, I don't know if it's going to be different or not. I'm just saying that at the beginning I presented a solid theory. It was solid because we can measure and calculate everything and put it in the right place. So it was a nice framework where everything fits. Here we can say, okay, this is like a phonon. We can take an alpha square F for that. But how would we measure it? I mean, just measuring chi doesn't tell you what is this coupling G. How do we know what G is? This is damped. It's very, very soft. It doesn't look like the alpha square F.
I mean, there are no well-defined peaks. Is that true?
For example. Yes?
Pi,
Yeah. So I think it's an analogy, but it's a good analogy, but it's not a perfect analogy. Of course, now we can calculate what, so the various approximations, RPA to particle self-consistency, flex, etc., which can actually be used to give some, put some flesh into this and try to identify those microscopic parameters. There's a huge literature on that. Still, I should mention that in two dimensions, there are some infrared singularities which are not fully sorted out after 10, 15 years of work. Finally, what people do really, they solve the strong K dependence of the couplings, and they solve the Migdal-Yashbury equations by summing over K and omega, rather than using the tricks which I explained to reduce the integral equations to just one variable. And then this is sort of a technical point that it's probably not important. Right. I mean, again, my job here is just to tell you the way I review the literature and I tell you in a critical way how I see it. I mean, I'll show you this concept has some merits in the sense that right now, as I said, there are two schools of thought, and I think that this spin fluctuation school of thought has developed a lot of things which at least can be used to try to interpret experiments. And it's the job of the strong correlation people to also do the same and try to make sense of what's going on. So the spirit of the rest of the lecture will be to, in the absence of completely accepted theory, we can try to look at all the phase diagrams, keeping basically these two points of view as complementary or as alternative points of views, and then try to ascertain in each one of the cases, just on phenomenological grounds, what are the important variables that determine the superconductivity? And there are many interesting questions. Is really two-dimensionality important? How coherent are these materials before they become superconducting? How close are they to the localization-delocalization transition? What are the possible pairing mechanisms, factors that limit the TC? And very important, what is the proximity or the connection to other phases? Okay, so now let's just to argue that indeed there are some merits on this, and this is something that comes from the spin fluctuation theory, and as I said, the damping of the quasiparticles, the term of the paramagnons, seems to control TC, and this is the plutonium, cobalt, indium 5, this is the cerium and the plutonium version. So the cerium version is to be here. This is the cerium with the maximum I showed at the beginning. And this is the plutonium version, which has actually a smaller maximum and probably more of a T-square than this one. So we have to compare the purple curve and the blue curve. And you clearly see that this one has a higher spin fluctuation theory if you want to interpret it in this language. And indeed, this seems to have a bigger TC. So this is a plot which is due to Ueda and Moria, where they try to argue that this TC and the spin fluctuation correlates. Now, is this really a predictive tool that allows us to guess TC from two normal state properties? That's, to me, the important question. Can this actually be tested for whether it's right or it's wrong? And the answer is probably yes and no. To my knowledge, yes. To my knowledge, question?
Yeah, can you say again how TSF was determined? So we compare resistivity in
T and LP? No. TSF, the resistivities are measured. So you have to ask yourself whether the resistivities here in some region can be interpreted in terms of a spin fluctuation theory. That's that's the crux of the argument. That's where all the little dirt is. So what these guys do is they just do a spin fluctuation theory, try to fit NMR and resistivity. From there, they pull a parameter, and then they correlate that with TC. So in principle, it's an algorithm that can be tested. So it can be falsified scientifically. You take two materials, which have different TCs. You measure their NMR. You measure the resistivity. You do the best possible fit to this spin fluctuation model. And then you extract TSF and TC. However, there's a problem because there are, in fact, four parameters in this spin fluctuation model because there are the couplings and there are the various parameters that govern the phonon. And there are only two quantities. So it all boils down to how good is this spin fluctuation fit to the measured quantities. And here I have somewhat doubts. But again, I mean, at least in this case, it does rationalize why these two materials are different. I should say, however, that one can also understand in a very, very simple way, also from other points of view, why the cerium 115s and the plutonium 115s have different TCs. And you see that the Kondo scale of the plutonium compound is bigger than the scale of the cerium compound. So assuming that this is your basic scale and that will scale with the basic scale, you can also explain that effect. So anyway, so that's sort of... You should be aware that this line of thought exists in the literature and has been applied to cuprates and heavy fermions. Now, just some word about Migdal Eliasberg. If you, I believe it's not so crucial to really solve all these equations in k-space and omega space. If you remember, I really derived these equations after sort of reducing the thing to the Fermi surface. And we can have here an index j, which I took to be last time to be the band index. But we could sort of imagine decomposing everything in an angular momentum index on the Fermi surface and keep two angular momentum, just the fully symmetric and the fully anti-symmetric, for example, a B2G and an A1G thing. And then we would get roughly the same answers that we got before with one crucial difference, that there will be one lambda that comes from Z and one lambda that comes from the pairing. And those things are fairly unrelated. And then still, there would be something like a Macmillan formula describing the results. I looked at the spin fluctuation models that people are solving. I noticed that what they're doing, they're taking these lambdas to be quite large. So this number is essentially 1. So all the action is coming from the prefactor, and that's sort of the spin fluctuation. So one can rationalize that plot from our understanding of Migdal Eliasberg theory once we understand in which regime those calculations are being run. Okay. So then one more thing, which is sort of interesting, and this is an insight in a paper by Lonzerich and Montoux. This field started with the cerium indium 3 and the cerium 115s. This was just a boring itinerant magnet for which Moria theory applies. So this is the TNL. It goes to 0 in 3 dimensions. And then you have a tiny here dome of superconductivity. This is the 115s. It has superconductivity, which is very sizable. And then L temperature competes with TC. And indeed, by Migdal-Eliasberg theory, I mean, they can more or less explain the trend why the two-dimensionality is helpful for the superconductivity. And again, you can look at the couplings. You can see that the two-dimensionality allows them to focus them more on the Fermi surface. So you have like a little bit more of nesting. And then you can understand that 2D is slightly better than 3D, even though this is not a qualitatively big effect, but it's present in their calculations. The other thing you can do is you can Fourier transform to real space, And you can see that in real space, the particles in two dimensions can exploit the attraction better than in three dimensions, in the sense that the order parameter of cosine kx minus cosine ky is better suited for a two-dimensional situation than for three dimensions. So, okay, this is just to give you an illustration of the things that have been done with this approach. To be fair to them, now concerning what one can do sort of with RVB, a question that I've been interested in is what determines if magnetism and D-wave superconductivity coexist microscopically or not? Because to me, that's a big difference when you look at all these materials. Sometimes you really have, in the same material, superconductivity and magnetism coexisting at the microscopic level with each other. And in some cases, these things really expelled. And at least within the Hubbard model, this is something that one can answer in a very, very sharp way. And the answer is that depending on the correlation strength, you have either coexistence or repulsion, in the sense that if the U is below the mod U, then one can actually solve the DMFT equations on the cluster, and that's work that Massimo Capone did. You can show that the order parameter as a function of doping in the Hubbard model, both the antiferromagnetic order parameter and the superconducting order parameter can exist, and they're finite. And they're finite even at half filling. So here we're studying superconducting state, and we're studying magnetic state. Well, if you look at the thing at very large U, you find a qualitative difference. The magnetic state, of course, survives up to half filling, but the D-wave superconducting state has this very characteristic dome, because now the superconductivity starts feeling the proximity to the mod state, and therefore it goes to zero. So this is what I would call correlated superconductivity, and that's where the paradigm of RVBE or correlated superconductivity is really important. And I would say this is uncorrelated superconductivity, where there is magnetism, but there is no motness. There's no desire to localize things at half filling. And that becomes really very, very, very apparent when we allow now the two solutions to be together at the same time. So now we can, I'm going back to this graph, and we can see what happens when we take both superconductivity and antiferromagnetism. And then you see now that that when we mix them, what happens is that the antiferromagnetism doesn't change at all, which you expect. But then the superconductivity feels a little bit the presence of the antiferromagnetism and is sort of weakened as you approach half filling. So that's sort of the mixed solution. But I would say that you have a very, very nice range where superconductivity and antiferromagnetism actually can coexist. And that's basically the important point. And that doesn't happen for large U. So I would say that the coexistence is something that signals to me weaker correlation in some sense that at large U. Yes?
I'm sorry, but on an example level, how do they distinguish between like a really mixed state and sort of homogeneous mixed state?
This has been studied in great detail for in the connection of these 115s. What one does is one does an MR, and one looks for if indeed you have homogeneous coexistence, then all the sites would be the same, and there would be only one NMR signal. On the other hand, if it's just that part of the sample is in one phase and another part is in another phase, then you find two different sites, each one behaving according to the pure phase. Well, clear is an exaggeration. I mean, there's a lot of arguments still in the literature as to what's really going on, whether they coexist microscopically or not. But I think in principle it's something that can be decided using experimental tools. So it's a valid scientific question. Okay, how am I doing with time, Antoine?
Well, you have maybe, it's really up to you and the audience. I mean,
10 minutes?
5-10 minutes.
5-10 minutes. So let me walk you now through some materials to illustrate now these points of what's more valid and wrap this thing up. So these are sort of the organic materials. Those are the batch core salts. And you see that basically these are charged. The interesting thing about this is that these are charged layers. All the high temperature superconductors seem to form in charged layers. I mean, also the two-dimensional ones are charged layers, where you have an insulating layer that is the salt. And then the organic layer is a negative charge layer. It's a positive charge layer. And in fact, that's where the whole theory of superconductivity comes from. I mean, the fact that the active layers in organic compounds are positively charged, so they are always doped with holes. So that's the origin of Hirsch's theory. And basically in here, I think these materials are very interesting because here one can actually really map them into well-defined models using modern techniques, and that's something that was done by Fukuyama and later by Imada and his collaborators. And this is something which has been studied in great detail in Orsay and in Japan. And here we really know that in the phase diagram of these materials, there is a mod point. So this is one example where it's not a problem of speculation, because when we're talking about those quantum critical points, that point cannot be seen. Okay, it's somewhere hidden somewhere. Here we know exactly where it is, and superconductivity and antiferromagnetism do appear in the same phase diagram. So it's clear here that the proximity to the Mott insulator can be quantified. And it's also something where the MFT, in this case, Boumzou Kyung and André-Marie Tremblay, have actually studied the phase diagram to see which type of superconductivity you have as a function of U over T and T prime over T. And then for small u, you have metal. For large u, you have antiferromagnetism. But in between, you have D-wave superconductivity, and you can have a spin liquid. So this is basically the experimental phase diagram, which, again, if you want to think of the large U regime, is very appealing, because here we have the spin liquid or the Mott insulator, and varying pressure is going like this from the spin liquid to the superconductor to the metal. So going like this in this phase diagram is like going like this in this phase diagram. So one can actually realize and see the concepts of strongly correlated superconductivity really at work. And the other place where one can see the concepts at work, and I will sort of finish on this note, is actually in the fullerenes. And I tracked the history of that also. And in the early 90s, when this was discovered, people thought, OK, as we apply pressure, The transition temperature, as you expand the lattice, what you expect is that the density of states goes up, because you're expanding the lattice, you're making the bands narrow, you're enhancing the density of states in the Fermi level, and people were very happy because the TC was going up when the lattice was expanding, and therefore declared that this was BCS superconductivity. But now, 10 years later, people have continued expansion, and they managed to expand it a little bit more than they had done before by putting cesium. And then you can get now a canonical, strongly correlated superconductivity type of phase diagram, because now the TC now can come down, and we can have a dome, and even this becomes antiferromagnetic. And if you have some doubts about those RVB concepts, 1 year ago, they managed to make this, to turn this cesium C60 from a BCC lattice or an A15 lattice into an FCC lattice. And the FCC lattice is strongly frustrated, and therefore the magnetism there is actually not robust, and it's very close to a spin liquid state, if you want, in the sense that the NL temperature for the FCC lattice is actually 2.2 Kelvin, which is nothing compared to the 40 Kelvin or the 46 Kelvin of the BCC lattice. So you can see that this phase here, what really matters is not that it was antiferromagnetically ordered. It's not the strength of the spin fluctuations or the TNL, but what matters is that this phase is actually Mott insulator. So this is really a realization of an RVB concept. So this is probably a good place to sort of wrap it up. So what did I try to do in these lectures? Well, I tried to give you some partial overview of what's known. And like any overview, it can be biased, but I try to lay out things in as unbiased way as I can possibly can, and try to give you where the state of knowledge in the field is. And I think there are many, many common aspects of all those high-temperature superconductors, but I think the answer might not be as simple as to proximity to some antiferromagnetic itinerant critical point. I think that there is really still a large space of high-temperature superconductors that we can actually investigate with our tools, and I think there are going to be many, many surprises in the years to come. So thank you for your attention.